Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashbery. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1337 features two classic stories from Life Rattle writer Jill McKelvey. Jill McKelvey was born the youngest of three daughters in Winnipeg in 1952. She grew up in Winnipeg, then moved with her family to Vancouver when she was a teenager, before returning to Winnipeg to attend university. She married at 23 and, 2 years later, moved with her husband from Winnipeg to Mississauga, just 3 weeks after adopting their son. We're going to hear about those events in one of McKelvey's stories tonight. In 2003, Jill McKelvey returned to school after more than 20 years away to complete her BA. She currently lives in Mississauga. McKelvey has written a series of stories about her family's experience of adoption, and we're going to listen to the opening two stories from a series of five tonight. Let's listen now to Jill McKelvey on Life Rattle. And remember that some Life Rattle stories contain language and situations some listeners may find offensive, so listener discretion is advised.
Barbara by Jill McKelvey. "Let's just see how your pregnancy goes," Barbara said for the fifth time that morning. Barbara, the social worker from Children's Aid, hadn't listened to me. "The doctor said the babies have both died, Barbara. I miscarried one last week, and I will probably miscarry the other one soon." "Well, we'll just see how your pregnancy goes." "I'm not pregnant anymore, Barbara." "Let's just wait and see." "Wait and see what?" I said. "How things go," Barbara said. "There's nothing to see, Barbara. If I don't miscarry, they'll perform an abortion." "I see. Well, we'll just wait and see how the pregnancy goes." "It's dead. They're dead. It's over," my voice squeaked. "I can see you're very stressed, Jill. I'm not surprised." "Barbara, I just want to stay on the adoption list. I don't want to have to start again." Barbara stood in my living room. She wore a pale blue linen suit, blue high-heeled shoes, and a taupe necklace. She carried a clipboard, and she spoke with a clipped voice. "In May 1976, Peter and I applied for adoption. The Children's Aid Society sent us Barbara. She had been assigned our case and would do our home study. She interrogated us about our thoughts, about our activities, and about our relationship with each other. She interrogated us about our parents, siblings, friends, enemies, employers, employees, and pets. She invaded our home, our property, and our life." Peter and I smiled, nodded, divulged, and expounded to Barbara. Peter and I received phone calls and drop-in visits at all hours. We kept our place clean, our clothes pressed, and the coffee pot on. In July 1977, with the help of fertility drugs, I got pregnant for the second time. In October 1977, I miscarried for the second time. Barbara looked up from her clipboard and watched me through smudgeless glasses. I leaned against the piano and rested my coffee mug on a sheet of Simon and Garfunkel music. I felt her steady gaze, and I knew what her next words would be. "As I told you before, it's the policy of the CAS at a time like this to give you some time to mourn your loss. We like to give 6 months to a year for you to get over it. Then we'll put you back on the list." "Barbara, I'll be fine if you just keep me on the list. I've been on the list for 18 months and I'm finally at the top. Please don't take me off the list." "Jill, it's a policy." "Barbara, everybody's different. It's terrible to lose a baby. But I hadn't grown attached to them. I'm sad and I'm disappointed and I do feel a loss for what might have been. But I want to get on with my life. I want a baby. I've always wanted to adopt. Knowing I'm at the top of the list has made all this bearable." Jill, you should just relax and see how your pregnancy goes. I wanted to hit Barbara. I sucked air up my nose. I held my breath. I lifted my coffee cup. My hand trembled. Air hissed through my lips. I held the cup with both hands. I looked through the steam at Barbara. Barbara dug around in her purse. She pulled out a black ballpoint pen. She lowered herself onto the edge of a dining room chair. She held her back straight. She held her knees together, crossed her ankles, and tugged at the hem of her short skirt. She placed the clipboard in her lap. Her pen scratched the paper. I wondered if she wrote, "Jill is stressed and tense. We don't recommend placement for a very long time." "Would you care for more coffee, Barbara?" I said. "No, thank you," she said. She didn't look up. I wandered off to the kitchen to pour myself another cup of coffee. I stopped outside the door of our spare bedroom. I looked in. Checkered animals roamed the walls. Yellow curtains hung across the window pane. A framed picture of Winnie the Pooh leaned against the clothes cupboard. My spine pressed against the doorframe. I tilted my head back and closed my eyes. Keep me on the fucking list, Barbara.
That was Jill McKelvey reading her story, Barbara. McKelvey's next story in this series is called Timothy. Let's hear that one now.
Timothy by Jill McKelvey. On November 10th, 1977, I had an abortion. The baby had died a month earlier. On November the 11th, 1977, a 16-year-old girl from Beauséjour, a French farming community in northern Manitoba, gave birth to a baby boy. She named him Gregory. The adoption agency phoned us on November 18th. A baby boy could be ours on November 25th. We named him Timothy. At 6 a.m. on November 25th, the movers and packers arrived at our home. Some of our furniture had already been shipped to Toronto. Everything that remained would be boxed, crated, and moved out the door by 5 p.m. The movers opened the double doors to clear Winnipeg skies and frosty air. I laid out the yellow one-piece snowsuit, white bonnet, and white mittens from the bay. I laid out the powder blue booties my mother sent special delivery from Vancouver, and the blue flannel nightgown made by Mrs. Bulgin, an 87-year-old friend of my grandmother's. I packed two baby bottles, a tin of formula, and two blankets in a small brown suitcase. I folded the tiny clothes on top of the blankets. I lugged the suitcase and the car bed to the front door. The mailman banged on the open door and handed us our last mail delivery. "Top of the morning to you, and good luck in the big city," he said. "Thanks, Dave. We'll miss you." "We're going to get our baby in 2 hours," I told him. Dave grinned. "A wee bairn, lots of changes in your life," he said. Peter and I said goodbye to our first home. We looked into the room with the orange, green, and yellow checkered animals on the walls. "They'll probably have this wallpaper in Toronto," Peter said. "It's a cute room. Too bad it was never used." We said goodbye to the movers and packers. "We're off to adopt a baby," we said to them as we walked out of the house. "It's a boy." They turned to each other with wide eyes. They shrugged, nodded, smiled, and waved us out the door. We drove to a strip plaza at the end of our street. Peter and I stared at each other across the Arborite table in the Charleswood Diner. We nibbled chicken fingers and checked the clock every 10 minutes. At 11 o'clock, we would be parents. At 11 o'clock, our lives would change. At 10:15, we asked for the bill. "We're going to adopt a baby now," I told the waitress. "Yeah?" she said. She scratched her scalp. "Cool." We pulled up outside a red brick four-story government building at 10:30 a.m. We sat in the car for 15 minutes with the engine running. We sat in silence. We held hands. At 10:45 a.m., we walked into the building. I carried the little brown suitcase. At 11:10 a.m., we walked out the door with Timothy Robin McKelvey. My grandmother, Miney, insisted on being the first stop on our route. "Be careful. It's slippery. Don't drop the baby," Miney shouted from her front doorstep. She stood 4 feet 11 inches. She wore a deep pink dress, white pearls, and black pumps. She bellowed her commands with a crisp British accent. "Cover his face. It's too cold for his lungs. Now come around this way. It's not as icy. Is his face covered?" I inhaled the cold winter air and looked at Peter. We rolled our eyes. Inside, I placed Timothy on a couch and took off his snowsuit. "Don't let him get a chill. Keep him wrapped up," Miney snapped. "Now look, his face is in the bright light. Turn him around." I sipped a glass of ginger ale that Agnes, the housekeeper, offered me. "Now, you say the girl and the boy were French-Canadian? Were they Catholic?" Miney asked. "I don't much care for French-Canadians or Catholics. What did you say their names were?" "Timothy doesn't have much hair, does he?" I looked at Timothy nestled in the cushions in Miney's library. Catholic? French? Bald? He looked perfect to me. We stayed 22 minutes. "We must be off, Miney," I announced. "Peter's grandparents are waiting." Miney shouted instructions as we walked to the car. "Be careful. Don't slip. Be sure he doesn't get a chill. Be sure he sleeps on his side. Be sure to call me. Call me tomorrow." Peter checked the rearview mirror. We waved. We smiled. We drove away. Peter's grandparents ushered us in the side door. "Everything's ready for you," Grandma said. "Peter will sleep in the basement, and Jill and the baby can have my old sewing room. It's nice and warm." "Thanks, Grandma." "That's great," I said. "Pat and Joan are dropping by to see the baby this afternoon," Grandma said. "And I think Norma, Vern, and Corey are coming as well." I looked at Peter. Peter looked at me. Timothy cried. "Maybe he's hungry," Grandma said. "Maybe he's tired," Grandpa said. "Maybe he needs changing. Or maybe he's just hot," I said. I didn't know. The Children's Aid Society had given me one lesson in diapering, feeding, and what they called pertinent baby information. Timothy wailed. I changed him. Grandpa held him. Grandma made formula. Peter warmed the bottle. I fed him. Timothy closed his eyes. The doorbell rang. The relatives arrived. Peter's stepmother, sister, aunt, uncle, and cousin bunched together in the front hall. They stripped off scarves and jackets and mitts and wet winter boots and arranged their bodies around the room. "Let's see the little fellow," Uncle Vern said. He snatched him from my arms, and Timothy disappeared inside his massive calloused hands. Timothy whimpered, and Vern one-handed him over to Aunt Norma. The warm room seemed to climb another 10 degrees. I felt the sweat in my armpits, and tiny droplets beaded a mustache above my upper lip. Aunt Norma patted his back and went over to sit beside Granny Pat. Together they examined his toes and fingers and the strawberry mark on his back. 8-year-old Corey ran circuits through the living room and kitchen. He jumped and banged and yelled and bumped into people. "Corey, come here and hold the baby," his mother called to him. "You don't mind, do you, Jill, if Corey holds the baby?" Corey dove onto the couch, and two ladies and a baby bounced up and down. "Be careful, Corey," Peter said. "Make sure you support his head." I held my breath and squished my lips between my fingers. "Oh, Corey knows all about babies," Aunt Norma said. "Don't you, Corey?" "When do you leave for Toronto?" Peter's sister asked me from across the room. I kept my eyes on Corey. "December 1st, I said. "Our furniture should arrive in Toronto in a couple of days." "Do you know anybody there?" No, I said. I moved closer to Corey. Have you had enough, Corey? I put one hand under Timothy's head and the other hand under his bottom. Corey sprang to his feet and bolted to the kitchen. Grandma passed around pickles and egg salad sandwiches. Timothy cried. Grandpa passed around drinks. Timothy cried harder. I paced and patted and paced. I'm going to try him in his bed, I said. Oh, we should all be going, Vern said as he quaffed down the last egg salad sandwich. Everybody jumped up. Our visitors picked through the pile of warm, woolly coats, fuzzy earmuffs, knitted scarves, and sodden mitts. Lovely baby. He's a lucky fellow. Safe journey. Call before you leave town. They kissed my cheeks and patted Timothy's head and rushed out the door. I paced and rocked and patted and paced. The sobs turned to hiccups and the hiccups slowly to tiny gasps. I sat down and picked up an egg sandwich. The phone rang. At 9 p.m., I made 6 bottles of formula, lay Timothy in his car bed, placed a flashlight on the bedside table, and lowered my head onto the flowered pillowcase. I pulled the car bed up close beside me and switched off the lamp. Silence. I held my breath. I listened for Timothy's breathing. I grabbed the flashlight and aimed it at Timothy. I couldn't tell. I switched on the lamp. I looked at Timothy's tiny body. I looked closer. I placed my hand on his back and felt the rise and fall. I turned out the light. I fell back against the pillow. I stared at the ceiling. I stared at the clock. 9:22 p.m. I closed my eyes. I held my breath. I listened for breathing. Crying filled the room. I looked at the clock, 1:03 a.m. I switched on the light. I sat up. The room seemed to move. I breathed in the warm air. My damp pajamas clung to my hot body. I tucked my long, wet hair behind my ears. I reached over and picked up Timothy. His body felt hot and sticky. I carried Timothy into the kitchen and took a bottle from the fridge. I ran hot water into a pot and placed the bottle in the water. Timothy's body jerked and lunged backwards. His little hands flailed in the air. I rearranged his body and held him closer to me. I grabbed the bottle from the water and squeezed the plastic formula bag. With one hand, I tried to force milk through the nipple to test the temperature. The nipple blew off the end of the bottle and hit the wall. Beige formula exploded, dripped down the walls and coated dishes drying in the dish rack. Beige formula ran down my sleeve and gathered in the crook of my arm. Jesus, I can't do this, I cried. Where is everyone? I grabbed another bottle and stuck it in the water. It's okay, it's okay, it's okay, I said. I waited 1 minute. I felt the bag. I didn't squeeze it. I pointed the nipple at Timothy. He sucked it into his mouth. The crying stopped. I wandered into the dark living room and huddled in the corner of the couch. Timothy stared up at me, his lips pumped. The clock on the mantel chimed the half hour. My wet body shivered. Timothy guzzled the bottle and I watched his eyes close and open, close and open. I lifted him up to pat his back. Come on, baby, burp, then we can go back to bed. Please, Bert, please. Timothy's face turned red and his mouth opened. Formula gushed from his mouth, hit me in the face, splashed on the walls, and ran down behind the couch. I turned his body away from me. He vomited again. Formula flew across the room, sprayed the lampshade, and splattered on the carpet. Timothy cried. I wrapped a blanket around his quivering body and held him close to me. Tears slid down my cheeks and ran down my neck. I stood up and walked to the top of the basement stairs. My fingers searched the wall for the light switch. I looked down the steep wooden staircase. I held Timothy in one arm and placed my other hand on the wooden railing. I stepped onto the first stair, one foot and then the other. I stepped onto the second stair, one foot and then the other. Timothy whimpered. I moaned. When I reached the bottom, I felt the cool air against my face. A door opened and Peter came toward me. What's the matter, Jill? Are you okay? The tears came faster. I can't do this. I just can't do this, I cried. What can't you do? Peter said. It's boiling in this house, and the bottle exploded, and he vomited up his milk, and he won't stop crying, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm so tired. And is it too late to give him back, because I just can't do this? Peter reached for Timothy and put his arm around me. We walked up the wooden stairs. I sat down on the living room couch and smelled the vomit. Peter brought me a blanket. I lay back against the cushions. My eyes closed. Make sure you lie him on his side and don't let him get chilled, I mumbled into the sofa.
That was Timothy, written and read by Jill McKelvey. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1337. Arnie Ackman recorded Jill McKelvey reading her stories. My name is Virginia Ashbery. Life Rattle is produced from Toronto and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.